This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Thanks for joining me today. Stick around for a fun story of how bluegrass music is making some inroads among young people. And we'll travel to the old Fiddler's Convention in Galax with Virginia Public Radio for that story. Otherwise, you're going to hear a lot of WMRA's Christopher Clymer-Kurtz in the next half hour. He was busy this week. Besides doing some election reporting, he also has the story of how Hollywood came to Winchester this fall. Make a Christmas movie in cooperation with the film program at Shenandoah University. He also looks into the wrangling over how to deal with overcrowding at Harrisonburg High. But first, this fall, the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality, or DEQ, issued a drought watch for much of the WMRA listening area, and a number of localities from Winchester to Charlottesville encouraged or mandated their residents to conserve water. And WMRA's Christopher Clymer-Kurtz has that story.
If you've gotten to hear this recently, I'm guessing you've soaked it up. This fall, Virginia has faced drought conditions in many areas. Early in October, the DEQ declared a drought watch for three of the state's 13 drought evaluation regions, in addition to one that was already in effect. Scott Cudless is the director of the DEQ's Office of Water Supply.
Well, it's fairly unusual. If you look at the rainfall numbers that we've seen for the calendar year, we are pretty much at near normal or slightly above rainfall in many places across the state. However, much of this rainfall fell during a period between the late springtime and early summertime. And since August, we have been seeing significant periods without any rainfall at all.
The dry conditions and DEQ drought watch played out differently in different localities. In Winchester, which is in the Shenandoah Drought Evaluation Region, officials issued a drought watch back at the end of September, said Perry Eisenach, the city's public services director.
We get our water from the North Fork of the Shenandoah River, and the flows had really started dropping quite a bit, so that's why we issued the drought watch. This is actually the second year in a row that we've done that, but before that, we hadn't done that for quite a while.
That city recommended a variety of voluntary conservation suggestions for residents, from limiting time in the shower to leaving grass clippings on lawns to hold soil moisture. Harrisonburg didn't issue an advisory. In a press release on October 23, it said that its water sources were able to meet the needed supply, but it encouraged residents to conserve when possible. Public Utilities Assistant Miranda Loki said that release was mainly to let people know about the DEQ's broader concerns.
We just wanted to release the information to say, you know, there are areas in Virginia that are experiencing drought. It's always good practice to not leave your faucets running. You don't have to always be watering your lawn, you know. We want to be good stewards of the environment.
At the end of October, the city's water supplies from Dry River, Switzer Dam, and North River were reportedly well above levels of concern. In the Switzer Dam,
we're way over. We're nowhere near, you know, we're not even near our watch. And watch, and our first one is a voluntary trigger. So that would be, we would ask you, if you are a citizen here, we would say, we would like you to volunteer to conserve water. That isn't even a mandatory trigger.
Still farther south in the Shenandoah region, Stanton Director of Public Works Tim Slowoski said he was keeping an eye on supply levels. Stanton Dam, he said, was recently down about 4.5 feet, but he's seen it as low as down 15 feet. And in his 20 years there, he's never issued conservation measures. The city also relies on a natural spring source, Gardner Spring, which he said was keeping up. Lexington is not in one of the DEQ's regions under a drought watch and didn't have any rationing efforts in place. In Charlottesville and Albemarle County, though, in the Middle James region, things seemed more dire. The Ravenna Water and Sewer Authority reported that its South Fork Ravenna Reservoir was full at the beginning of August, but down to less than half capacity by the end of September. The authority's executive director, William Mollier, said that drastic drop was due to a combination of lack of rainfall, community water use, some leakage around water release gates, and possible inaccuracy in a gauge measuring inflow. Mollier said that all along, the three reservoirs that serve the region had a lot of water in them collectively, but they are not yet connected with pipes that could balance their levels, something that is anticipated as part of the community water supply plan. The Ravenna Reservoir, which suffered that drastic water level drop, is the sole provider to one of the area's two water treatment plants, so the area was first requested to voluntarily conserve water and later placed under mandatory restrictions.
We're pleased that we've gotten the recent rains and that the reservoir has refilled and the community has responded, so that's been a big help going forward. We're going to have a lot of lessons learned, a number of lessons learned that we can apply and help us stay out of the mandatory restrictions in the future, we hope.
Mollier said that the Ravana Water and Sewer Authority anticipates that mandatory water restrictions will continue until high water levels have been sustained in the reservoir for an extended period. Charlottesville's Director of Utilities, Lauren Hildebrand, said last week that recent rainfall has helped substantially.
We want to make sure it's sustainable. So mandatory water restrictions are still in place until a little time has passed.
That could be a matter of weeks or a couple of months. Looking further ahead, Scott Cudless of the DEQ said what we don't need is a second dry winter.
Well, we need at least a normal winter. Last winter was very, very dry, but then we got above normal precipitation right at the end of the recharge period in the late winter, early spring. That might help again, but what we've seen in the past is when we have more than one winter in a row that has a low recharge period, it makes it really challenging in the summertime.
The web posting of that story came with a lot of links for you to check out more information about the water supply in your area. Well, Christopher got to cover a much lighter story last week, but it centers around a pretty big deal in Winchester. This fall marks the start of something new at Shenandoah University. It's a partnership between the university and a film and television production company. It's starting off with the university as the set for an upcoming feature film starring Barry Bostwick and Jennifer Stone. And Christopher visited the set for this story.
Meet CEO Santa Claus, slim, brusque, down to business.
No, the more we pay in overtime, the less we have in our quarterly earnings. No go.
The union isn't going to like that.
But so what's new? Set up a lunch with the union rep. What's his name? Pickles?
Sparkle, sir. Pickles is head of accounting.
More from there in a bit. First, though, here's what's going on in the words of a key figure in the arrangement between Shenandoah University and Capital Arts Entertainment, Paul DeFranco. He is semi-retired from entertainment. He did a lot of music supervising, among other things, and now is a distinguished adjunct assistant professor of music production and recording technology at SU.
I thought I could escape Hollywood by coming out here, and it followed me. Some dear friends of mine said, "Why don't we make movies together with your students and our money?" And I said, "Okay." How do you say no to that?
The idea is for the SU Capital Arts relationship to continue as part of the university's film program, which will have a major next fall, he said. This fall's project is directed by Blaine Weaver.
Well, we're making a film here called Santa Girl. It's a comedy, romance, family movie set in Christmas. Santa Claus has a daughter named Cassie who goes off to college, and it's kind of a cross between the movie Elf and an episode of Gilmore Girls. But hopefully it's charming and fun and Christmas happy-making.
Weaver, his producers, and his director of photography are the only experienced filmmakers on site. Aside from a few lead actors from L.A. and some local professional makeup artists, everyone else working on the film are 60-plus university students and faculty and staff.
The swiveling is okay. The swiveling is actually kind of important a little bit. You don't want to move your placement.
Weaver has written, directed, acted, can you hear Peter Pan too in his voice, and said that while working around class schedules has slowed things down, he's worked with an experienced crew before, so that's not a problem. While we were talking, it wasn't a student who interrupted. It was Barry Bostwick about his cufflinks.
Very important decision.
Yes, Barry.
Do you like those? It's cleaner.
It is cleaner. You don't like the guys?
Well, I think it's good, but it's just, it takes a while to figure out what the hell it is.
All right, well, let's change it then.
What do you think?
I defer. I think that's beautiful. And it's cleaner.
Yeah.
It'll be easier.
The director deferred to the actor. That doesn't happen very often.
When you have Barry Bostwick on the set, you listen to what he says. Yeah. See what I just did?
Bostwick was Broadway's original Danny Zuko in Grease and is known for his roles in the Rocky Horror Picture Show and Spin City. He said that working with students feels familiar.
I feel like I'm at home with my kids. I've got a 22-year-old boy and a 21-year-old daughter, and they know the basics of life, and then you just sort of have to sneak in, you know, some of the specifics.
One very involved student is Darcy Pierce.
Oh my God, it's the most incredible experience of my college career. I'm a senior, and like I get texts from the producers. Like that's insane. Like
Pierce is an acting major. She's working as director's assistant, and she appears in the film.
I play Deirdre. She's a girl that Cassie, Santa's daughter, meets at college and is kind of like a bully.
Cassie is played by Jennifer Stone. She's been acting since she was 6. She's 24 now and is known for being Harper on Disney's Wizards of Waverly Place.
It's cool to see the vigor of someone who isn't been jaded by the business yet. They still have stars in their eyes, and they've really gotten into the technicality of it, and they're really excited about every step of the process. That really allows me to sort of see the details again and appreciate them all over again through the student's eyes. So it's been really cool.
Back on set, Weaver focuses on a rather imposing, tall, lean Santa in a gray business suit surrounded by scurrying elves and wearing red socks.
Basically, Santa Claus has taken a harsher tone, and now he's the CEO of Kringle Industries. And so he's a businessman, except for he has this Santa Claus aspect to him. So this is the reveal of this character. So we build up a lot of suspense. We get little bits of him. We get, you know, his cufflinks and whatnot. All right, here we go, guys.
And here's more from that scene.
And Ash, union rep. What's his name? Pickles?
Sparkle, sir. Pickles is head of accounting.
Well, whatever. What elves need to make toys as much as toys need to be made.
Solid logic, sir. Sugar and spice department is having major problems with the candy canes.
That doesn't look right.
Good eye, sir. Worldwide peppermint shortage.
I don't want any excuses. I want results, Cottontail.
It's gumdrop, sir. Huh? Let's get back to work, fellas.
Santa Girl is expected to be released next Christmas.
And if you're interested in hearing more from actors Barry Bostwick and Jennifer Stone, Christopher sat down with them for interviews, and we've posted those with the story you just heard at WMRA.org. Christopher's final story last week involved the untangling of a complex issue, what to do about overcrowding at Harrisonburg's only high school. In June, the Harrisonburg City School Board unanimously endorsed building a second high school for the city. Even as the city pursues that, a variety of voices are weighing in on what they want to see happen.
No one disputes that Harrisonburg High School is overcrowded. Its classroom capacity is 1,350 students, but this year more like 1,800 are enrolled. And enrollment projections show continued increases. Earlier this summer, a school's report noted a few possibilities. The original building has an annex option, which would add space for 800 more students at an estimated cost of $48 million. A separate addition option is similar in size and cost. Or, and this is what the school board endorsed in June, a second high school of similar size could provide another 1,300 seats. A cost estimate for a second high school has yet to be nailed down. One number floating around is $94 million.
We saw this locomotive coming down the tracks when my kids were in kindergarten.
Andy Arndt is part of a group called 4HHS2, which sees building a full-blown second high school as inevitable.
My frustration as someone who's lived in the city for 20 years now is we keep playing catch-up. But we shouldn't, because we have the data. We know that we exceed the enrollment projections. So I would like to see the city build for the class of 2050. Not the class of 2020.
But some are concerned about whether the city can handle the financial strain of building a second high school. Students Over Structures is a political action committee that has sent out mailers and put up red signs around town decrying a, quote, $100 million school. It's funded by Forbes Development LLC, Ashby LLC, JM Apartments LLC, and Living Green LLC. Living Green gave $7,500 to Students Over Structures and is the effort of Barry Kelly, CEO of Matchbox Realty. Kelly is also on the Land Use and Transportation Advisory Committee for the Harrisonburg Planning Commission.
One of our goals in land use is that we would like to see more home ownership. Obviously, when you increase a cost to anything, you have less of it.
He said the higher property taxes to fund a $100 million school would mean reduced affordability for first-time homebuyers and less money for other city projects and opportunities. He wants all options explored, like having some city students attend Rockingham County schools, for example. Developer Bruce Forbes gave $5,000 to students over structures. He said the upper spending limit for a new high school should be $60 million.
You don't build the Taj Mahal.
Forbes describes himself as, quote, pro-education, and said that a new building might not be needed because education is going to change in the same way that e-commerce has affected brick-and-mortar stores. And, he said, higher tax rates could increase his annual $200,000 in city property taxes by more than $80,000. He doesn't think most homeowners in the city realize how higher taxes would impact them.
If you go down and you go through 10 homes and you ask them, what's your new tax rate going to be? What do you mean? Oh, I'm willing to sacrifice $30 more income for education. Have you ever heard that one?
While some groups are calling a second high school inevitable and others are warning against a high price tag, another voice has been suggesting an idea that he thinks could save money and alleviate the overcrowding relatively quickly. George Pace was CEO of Rocco when it sold to Cargill back in 2001 and was on the city council during the construction of the current high school. He's been promoting his idea for a while now, but doesn't think anyone's buying it.
It looks to me kind of like the train's left the station, as I like to say.
Pace thinks the city could alleviate the overcrowding by switching from its current middle school system model to a junior high system model, making the high school just grades 10 to 12. The city could use existing buildings for grades 7 and 9 and accommodate 6th graders in the elementary schools by using mobile classrooms until an additional elementary school could be built for much less than a new high school would cost.
That buys you time. If all the projections are right, and 4 or 5 years from now, we need more space at the single high school, then you build the annex.
Whatever is decided, new school advocate Andy Arndt said the decision needs to be made with transparency and a variety of voices in the discussion.
We're not always looking at the same numbers. We need to look at the same enrollment projections. We need to know what our bond capacity is, what the tolerance for a tax increase would be. It's almost like you've got all of these switches that you can adjust to make this really hard decision. And let's take these different slider switches and see where the sweet spot is, where we can come to consensus on this thing.
Arndt said a new school would be built too late to benefit her own kids, but as a city resident, she's still in favor of taking on the challenge of a new high school.
There are people who are like holding up signs saying, raise my taxes, build a school. Our schools matter to all of us because it's our property values and our values as a community.
City Council member Richard Baugh is pretty sure whatever the high school overcrowding solution will be, it's going to be expensive. And if people are concerned about where that money is going to come from...
Okay, good, because I'm worried about the cost too, so we're fine.
For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
In order for music forms to survive, it's important for them to be rediscovered by new generations of musicians. As Virginia Public Radio's Sandy Hausman discovered at the Old Fiddlers Convention, bluegrass has made a comeback among the very young.
Calm down. Got plenty of room over here.
The Old Fiddlers Convention in Galax is a must for John Lohman. He makes a point of attending this yearly event to play and take notes for his employer, the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.
You know, when I started in this position as state folklorist, there was a lot of concern among older people that this music is dying out. They were real nervous about kids being too into video and the internet. And I could tell you that the music has never been stronger with kids. Every year it blows your mind more.
This year, more than 100 people under the age of 16 entered the competition. Pat Jarrett, who's been coming here since 2012, was impressed.
These kids are outstandingly talented. I mean, I think the oldest one was maybe 15, and they were playing like pros.
Thirteen-year-old Presley Barker brought his guitar, teaming up with three other musicians at a campground the night before the contest.
I had a lot of fun.
And was the crowd particularly with you on this one?
Yes, I think they was. I think they had a good time, so did we.
Many young musicians got an early start. Ruth Shumway, for example, took up the fiddle at age 3.
My aunt recommended my mom that she start me in a classical method known as Suzuki because it helps your brain with math and things. But once I had my first recital, I knew that I wanted to be on stage as much as I possibly could.
The ranks of young bluegrass musicians have grown dramatically since 2000 when school guidance counselor Helen White launched a program called Junior Appalachian Musicians, or JAM.
My interest was in giving kids that weren't necessarily athletes or good students, giving them something else to try and giving them a place to belong.
At first, she had doubts.
We had about 20, 25 kids that signed up for the program, and it was like, well, we don't like this kind of music. But we put those kids on stages, and we had their picture on the wall by the cafeteria, and we had their extended families come out to the Allegheny Jubilee to play for a dance, and the next semester, we had 90 kids. They love the attention.
Today, there are 40 JAM programs in six states. And 70-year-old guitar maker Wayne Henderson, who recalls being one of very few children who played bluegrass, says its future is assured.
I don't see how it could be in any kind of trouble. When you see these youngins that are playing this old-time music that are so good, and they keep working on it, come to this event in hopes of winning a ribbon, and it's a big deal to win a ribbon at Galax.
Presley Barker and Ruth Shumway know that. She placed second in the youth fiddle competition, while Barker's band came in first. In Galax, I'm Sandy Hausman.
I'm Chanel Varani, and this is Our Island Universe. For me, one of the most influential storytellers and one of my heroes was Dr. Carl Sagan, born on November 9, 1934. He was a scientist, an author, a science popularizer, and science communicator. He was a frequent guest on The Tonight Show, hosted by Johnny Carson. His PBS series, Cosmos, was the most widely watched series in the history of American public television. He published more than 600 scientific papers and articles, was the author, co-author, or editor of more than 20 books. His scientific legacy is just as important. Sagan argued the now accepted hypothesis that the high surface temperatures of Venus can be attributed to and calculated using the greenhouse effect, the same concern we have on our planet with our human-induced climate change. To me, however, his most important legacy was that of inspiring hundreds of millions of humans to think about science. He made us think about our planet, the pale blue dot, and the impact we are having on it. He forced us to think not about our tribal affiliations, the color of our skin, or the country in which we were born, but to see ourselves as a species yearning to discover its place in the cosmos and reach for the stars. I am Chanel Varani, director of the John C. Wells Planetarium at James Madison University.
I have to say, I really appreciate that remembrance by Chanel. I grew up watching the original Cosmos on public TV. I love Carl Sagan. Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Klein May Realty, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Nancy Barber, Pam and Jim Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg in Rockingham County. If you'd like to support our news coverage, go to WMRA.org, mouse over News, then click on News and Information Fund. All our stories are archived at that website. And follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on the coverage. And here's a great way to keep up with local and statewide news each day with WMRA. Subscribe to our daily news podcast. It's called the WMRA Daily. Look for the WMRA black coffee mug with a yellow sticky note that says Daily at WMRA.org. We've got all the details there. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.